choke points. Well, good to go. Toll users need to get their accounts in order. The system's going to be shut down for 2 weeks so the state can implement a new website and update the customer service center. So, well, Chris is going to tell us what this entails. I guess we all have to go online then, huh?
The Good2Go tolling system goes dark June 18th. After 10 years of service, the website just doesn't do what customers need it to, and the call center needs an upgrade.
Our Good2Go website and our customer service phone line will be offline and unavailable. Customers won't be able to access their accounts or make payments. But we will still be collecting tolls during this time.
The Washington Department of Transportation's Jennifer Charlebois says two new vendors are now on board for the upgrades. The goal is to make most transactions doable online without having to call the call center. Right now, if you need to change your password, update your payment information, or dispute a toll, you have to call the call center. All of that will now be available online.
We really tried to focus on modernizing the website and focusing on the customer experience, adding a lot of more self-service functionality based on what we've heard from our customers as the things that they do most commonly that they want to be able to do on their own online without having to call into the customer service center.
You will no longer have to put $30 on your account and keep a balance. You'll be able to pay as you go. Your credit card will be charged for each trip. You'll be able to request a callback while waiting on hold with customer service if you don't have the time to hang. You'll also be able to request text alerts from Good2Go. The call center's Patty Michaud says it's all about making things more efficient for the customer.
We all got together and took feedback from customers and also from the call center to try to develop tools to make things more efficient. And so once we have that up and running, we're hopeful that customers will use our website more often, and then it will make it more efficient for our customer service reps to help customers.
The call center is hiring about 150 new people to train on the new system. The entire system will be down for 2 weeks, so Charlebois is asking the 2 million Good2Go customers to check their accounts before everything goes dark.
It would be a great idea for them to take a look at their account, make sure all of their contact information is up to date. They should also consider adding funds to their account prior to our shutdown. And then for customers who don't have accounts, you know, if they've got a couple of Good2Go toll bills sitting on their kitchen counter, great idea for them to pay those now.
As Charlebois mentioned, tolls will continue to be collected during the two-week shutdown, but you will get extra time to pay or dispute your bills. They are not going to penalize anyone while the system is down.
Okay, so if I have auto pay enabled on my Good2Go account, do I have to do anything?
No, not necessarily. But what you don't have to do anymore is put a balance on it. You know how you normally have to keep that $30 in there and it keeps refreshing.
But it does that automatically, doesn't it?
Correct. But now, yeah. But a lot of people are always, you know, especially people who join, and they're like, well, why do I have to put $30 on this now? Why don't you just charge my card when I use it? Yeah. So it's really now more of a function for people who are getting into the system now. Mm-hmm. They don't have to worry about putting funds in there. They just have to put their credit card info in there. But yeah, if you've been to their website, it's archaic. I mean, who has to call a call center to change their password on a website? I mean, that just doesn't, it's just, yeah, they really need this upgrade in a bad way.
I'm just wondering why they have to delay the tolls by 2 weeks and still, you would ingratiate people to your department, the department of, which arguably is one of the most frustrating departments to deal with, if you would just give people a 2 week reprieve. Like, what's it going to hurt? How much money are you making in 2 weeks? Just give something back to the people.
You got to remember that some of these tolls, like on 520 and Highway 16, are part of the bonding that go back to paying for the construction of those new facilities. And they always say that they can't afford to not get that money coming in to make sure they meet their financial requirements.
2 weeks. I mean, it would do a lot.
Did you not see the movie 300? Don't kill the messenger.
I'm mainly
don't kick me into a well
out there into the airwaves to see if anybody at the DOT can pitch it to their boss. Like, yeah, hey, people don't like us very much. How about we just give people 2 weeks free?
Yeah, and you're not alone. A lot of people say that, you know, too. And I know that's a lot of the feedback that
because
the Good2Go gets. You know, they could do it on 405 if they wanted to,
because
that's a congestion pricing model. Same with 167. They could do it there, but they can't really on 520 or 167
or on the
99 toll.
Free the toll. Free the toll.
Yeah, you have to find something that rhymes, Colleen.
Oh.
And Hannah Scott joins us with an update on several stories involving policing. There is a charging decision expected today in the Tacoma police custody death of Manny Ellis. Seattle's police chief has made good on a promise, and a state patrol trooper has lost his license to be a cop in this state. Here's Hannah's report.
That former state patrol trooper, Sean Carr, the son-in-law of state patrol chief John Batiste. He resigned last July after the allegations of him having a sexual affair with a woman while on duty came to light. And yesterday, the Criminal Justice Training Commission issued a decision decertifying Carr, effectively barring him from ever being a cop in Washington State again. The story first came to light after a joint investigation with the Northwest News Network and the Seattle Times. In its decision yesterday to decertify Carr, the CJTC found that he had carried out this sexual affair with a woman while on duty, including two encounters that the panel deemed as non-consensual. This case was a test of the state's existing narrow decertification law for police officers, which rarely leads to any officer being decertified. The legislature has just passed a bill that will broaden the circumstances in which decertification is allowable for an officer, but this case was not under that law, so a significant decision from the CJTC here. In Seattle, a promise kept from Seattle Police Chief Adrian Diaz, who had reversed a decision by the Office of Police Accountability a couple of weeks ago with the finding of misconduct against a lieutenant who had made the call to deploy tear gas, blast balls, and pepper spray against a crowd of thousands of mostly peaceful protesters last June on Capitol Hill in an effort to disperse the crowd. At the time, Chief Diaz explained he was not comfortable holding that lieutenant accountable for the decision that was, in his opinion, the result of separate calls made on the ground by a higher-ranking officer.
There was a belief that he should be held accountable to some decisions that were made that day during the actual protests or demonstrations. I don't disagree with the findings of the OPA. I disagreed with who should be held responsible for those decisions. And so I reversed the finding to the lieutenant that was involved.
But Diaz declined to say who had made the call at the command level and how they would be held accountable.
I really had to close out that part of the investigation with the Office of Police Accountability. And from that information that OPA was acquired through interviews and through even a management action, we know decisions were made at a higher level. Right now, we're working to determine, you know, the way to ensure full accountability based on what we've learned from these interviews and from the actual investigation. And that is still going to be an ongoing process.
The chief took a lot of heat over the decision, but explained,
you know, we're trying to focus on a stratified model of accountability. So where certain ranks are making decisions, I think we've worked over the course of the last year in doing that, in even in these demonstrations, ensuring that where decisions are made at the lieutenant rank, at the captain rank, and an assistant chief rank. And I think there are some things that are very easy when you come to when you deploy. If you had to deploy CS over the last year, it's been at the rank of a chief of police making that decision. And before, you know, that's where the, you know, some of that confusion was created. And that's where we're focused on right now.
He also promised there would be accountability and kept that promise yesterday in a letter to the City Council Public Safety Committee Chair Lisa Herbold, revealing that higher ranking officer was an assistant chief who was serving as an incident commander that day, and that the chief had now busted him back down to the rank of captain based on his actions managing that situation and his lack of confidence in the captain's ability to serve as an incident commander. Meantime, we'll get an answer to another big accountability question today when we find out whether any one of the Tacoma police officers involved in the in-custody death of Manuel Ellis will be charged. The state attorney general has said he will release that today. We expect to get that in the form of a press release or announcement on social media, not as a press conference. Manny Ellis died several weeks before George Floyd after a late-night interaction with Tacoma police, who claimed that he was acting erratically and attacked them. Witnesses later would contradict that. Ellis's case eerily similar to that of George Floyd's, but didn't get public attention until afterwards, in part because of these words he was heard uttering as police tried to restrain him.
Can't breathe.
The "I can't breathe" comments rippled through protests that were going on at the time, adding to the contentious protests happening throughout the state. Many are poised to protest again over this decision. Ellis's family has been demanding answers for some time, accusing the state of being too slow at handling this investigation.
Hurry up this investigation.
In February, Attorney James Bible had this to say.
A black man was lynched in Tacoma, Washington. His name was Manuel Ellis.
And the reason that even though that happened before George Floyd, it didn't get as much attention at the time was just the quality of the video.
Like the Tacoma police said there wasn't any video in the beginning, and that video came to light after the family started making some noise. Yeah. I think there was somebody in a car who was videoing from nearby who had witnessed this, and then there was another video that came out later. None of it was police video, though.
Yeah. On the other, the decertifying, this is the first time I can recall of that ever happening.
It's been, I want to say there's just a handful of cases that they've ever seen somebody be decertified. It's a really, really narrow way. 230 officers have ever been decertified in our state in the history. Actually, that's since 2003. Four of them, by the way, for having sex on duty, as was the case here. But it was it's very narrow. It's hard to prove. You have to really, really be able to prove, or they have to admit to what they've done, that kind of a thing. This was not, and because this was from last year, this was not under the new decertification bill that was just passed by the legislature, which will expand on that, right? That put a lot more misconduct that would fall under the decertification process.
It shows that it has been a possibility all along, which is difficult to do.
Mm-hmm.
How many did you say there have been?
230. That's since 2003.
Since 2003.
You don't hear about it a lot, though. No, I had not ever heard about decertification until the legislature proposed the bill this year. But as they said, it's very difficult to get someone to be decertified. The panel that will decide these things is going to be changed eventually. A few years from now, will be all civilian led. The majority of this panel was law enforcement, which also is fairly interesting.
Now that means that's permanent. Like you can never get a job in law enforcement again.
Not in this state. Based on this entire system that they're going to have, where there's data about the misconduct of other officers that other agencies are required to check before they hire that officer, so they can't get out of, if they're about to be fired from one agency.
Within the state. So what about other states? Yeah. The states share information on this?
No. Nope, not yet. They will have, I think we'll have our own database up and running. So if a state wanted to, they could go ahead and check our state if they saw that the officer was here eventually, I believe is the idea, but it wouldn't be a requirement. So you'd still have the ability for someone to slip through the cracks, unfortunately.
Yeah, I suppose there's always the possibility of redemption, but in other words, he would still be free to get a job in another state.
Yes, he would still be free to get a job in another state. Mm-hmm.
And we're sort of out of time here, but I mean, in the Seattle Police Department case where the higher up was punished, is that unusual or is that extraordinary?
I think it's out of the norm. I think we've not seen that, or at least it hasn't been made very public in recent memory for me. But then, I've heard some folks in community who say this guy's a patsy. They don't know that if you're going to hold one person, there were more than one incident commander that first weekend of big protests, all the way up to the pink umbrella incident. Yeah. And it was a collective, many believe, failure on the part of the entire command staff. And
so they
to
think
hold
more
one,
than just this one person should have been punished. Then.
Exactly. Nice. So. I've not seen this happen before. So I think at the very least, the chief made good on his promise to hold someone accountable because community was getting quite upset about that.
Hannah Scott. Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Time for the Daily Dose of Kindness brought to you by Heritage Homecraft. Do you recognize this story?
In the light of the moon, a little egg lay on a leaf. One Sunday morning, the warm sun came up, and pop, out of the egg came a tiny and very hungry caterpillar.
That's right. Author Eric Carle reading The Hungry Caterpillar. Carle passed away. Here's Peter King with a look back on his success.
Eric Carle wrote or illustrated more than 75 children's classics, but he may have been best known for this.
Out of the egg came a tiny and very hungry caterpillar.
The very hungry caterpillar has eaten through 26 different foods for decades, selling 40 million copies in 60 languages since 1969. Eric Carle once called it a book of hope, and pediatricians used it to set an example for children to eat properly. His family says Carle died at his home in Northampton, Massachusetts. He was 91. Peter King, CBS News.
And the author reflected on the book's success in this commemorative video just 2 years ago.
It took me a long time, but I think it is a book of hope. Children need hope.
That's why we're sharing it today in the Daily Dose of Kindness to Eric Carle, for all that he brought us with hope and for what he gave us as children, for our children, for our children's children, and beyond. No doubt it's going to continue to be passed down. He illustrated more than 70 books for kids, but his caterpillar story became one of the best-selling children's books of all time. I think I might have myself like 3 copies of just that caterpillar book among so many others of his. So I just wanted to share that. He's such a gentle soul and a kind person, giving our children hope.
Here is G. Scott. One of the things we have to come to grips with is how to compliment someone that we haven't seen in a year. And usually it's because you look at them and you see that they're remarkably thin. So do you come out and say that or not?
Yeah, I mean, I don't come out and say, hey, you look thin. I don't say that. I just would keep it simple. Hey, you look great. You look good. Hey, I haven't seen you in a while. Man, you look good. Or I'd say something like, man, the pandemic's treated you well or something like that. And that's where I might get in trouble. But I have no problem with that. Colleen, let me check in with Colleen, because a lot of times Colleen got to tell me some things. Colleen, are you okay if I say, hey, as a matter of fact, yesterday I hadn't seen you in a while. Right?
You didn't say anything to me, G. You gave so many other people these like hearty hellos. And I was like, hi, G. And you were like, hey, what's up, Colleen? I was like, oh.
Did I do you like that?
You did. Maybe you were concentrating on a story, but that's okay. I'm super sensitive about people who like me or don't like me. So it's just my trauma I'm working through.
So what's your thoughts on me saying you look
great? I think it depends on your relationship with the person. Are you close enough to say to your coworker, you know, hey, you look good. What's changed? Or, my goodness, have you lost weight? I mean, you look like you've just been working. You know, it depends on your relationship. If you're friends with that person, you should be able to point out changes in their appearance, because you're close enough to talk about those things. And if somebody has lost weight, it's highly likely they want to talk about losing weight, right? So you're just opening the door for that conversation. The problem is, and I think your co-host Ursula pointed it out yesterday, that when that weight starts coming back on, those compliments disappear.
Really,
and that's
quick,
what feels bad.
Look, we have to give everyone that's listening right now, we have to give them context right now as for where this is coming from. So Ursula and I, we brought up the story. Demi Lovato, if you guys know who that is, Demi Lovato just recently did an interview, and she shared how commenting on weight loss and weight gain can be both have negative effects. So she basically was saying that, hey, it is not a good thing to tell somebody, oh, you look great, you look like you've lost weight. That's what she's saying. And I said to, and so Ursula's saying, yeah, you got to kind of understand, you don't know if someone has an eating disorder, you don't know what's going on. And my thing was this: we are really at a time in our world where you just don't know what to say. So what's going to happen is Colleen, who hasn't seen me in a long time, is going to say, hey, G. And I'm going to say, what's up, Colleen? Because I want to be safe. I want to make sure I'm good.
I look good. I don't know how anybody's losing weight during the pandemic, because all I've been doing is sitting on my, you know what, you know, eating food and stress eating. You know, unless you're Sully and you get COVID and lose 30 pounds in 2 weeks. But
we can't say anything, guys. This is what this is about, right? And we're talking about it, and I just got, not really frustrated, but kind of frustrated on the show. I'm just saying, look, we are getting to a point where we just don't know what to say, because anything out of our mouth has the potential of making someone feel bad or hurting someone's feelings, or you might be offensive. Like, look, Sally here in accounting, all I was trying to say is that you look great, look like you've lost weight. Why did you turn me into HR? That's all I'm saying.
See, at my age, when my friends meet, we look at each other and say, you look great. That's just a way of saying, wow, you're still alive.
Oh. So.
now,
were the comments about your beard at your recent, old men of radio?
It was, when are you going to shave it? And I said, I've had it trimmed. What do you mean, when are we going to shave it? It's beautiful. What are you talking about? Yeah.
Well, they also talked about, and then, and then people were texting into the show, and then I was learning, like, because in different cultures, some folks say, you know, hey, you look healthy. You look like you're getting bigger. You know, that means prosperity, right? That means you're doing well. Like, oh, you're eating good. You got a little money in your pocket. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, man. We're just getting to the point where I'm going to start coming on you guys' show. And I'm going to make sure I talk with James. Like, okay, what are we talking about? I need to know exactly what we're going to say. I don't want to say anything wrong to Colleen or Dave. I don't want to bring up anything. You know, Dave, I don't want to bring up what happened to you in the hallways in school and about the lockers, you know?
Yeah, well, what do you know about that?
You told me they would grab you and give you wedgies.
No, it wasn't wedgies. They made me salute.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
You didn't tell us. Wait, what happened?
What do you mean, what happened?
Why did they make you salute, bro?
Because I was small and a year younger than everybody else. And so when I got into the locker, anybody who was older than me made me salute. That until we got to the wrestling unit, right? And in wrestling, you're selected by weight. Well, I was pretty strong for my weight. So once I got to wrestle the kid, he stopped making me salute.
Nice.
Yeah. But that's a story for another
just
day.
Desserts. Don't you want to go back in time and be Dave's buddy? Just
no.
I do.
Nobody wants to be Dave's buddy. You'd have injuries all the time. New research from the UW School of Medicine into opioid addiction medication has been released. And Chiropractor Hannah Scott says at least one researcher says there is positive news from the results.
The goal of the study?
We wanted to understand what's really happening, how it's being used. I do a lot of work in terms of clinical support, trying to help providers use this medication effectively and do a lot of education with the community about what is opioid use disorder and the role of medications. And specifically what we know around buprenorphine and also the medication methadone is that these are medications that are highly effective for treating opioid use disorder.
But lead researcher Dr. Caleb Banta-Green at the UW School of Medicine says...
So we want to understand more about what's going on. Are people actually accessing this medication? How are they using it? What does it look like? Because typically, when people think about treating opioid addiction, they often think about inpatient or detox. And those actually are not very effective treatments for people with opioid use disorder. They can be if people use medication, but medications are really the front line. So how are people actually using these in the real world?
So
great about this study is we were able to use the Washington State Prescription Monitoring Program, and that database is potentially everybody in the entire state. We weren't looking at some little group of, oh, these are private pay insurance folks, or these are public pay insurance folks. This is everybody. So our results apply to the entire state. And they're also really useful for other states as well to understand what this looks like.
The study of over 25,000 people in Washington State who had received their first dose of buprenorphine or Suboxone found that they were only using it for an average of 84 days.
The minimum quality standards are 6 months, and many people do well on these medications for multiple years. So seeing that the first time a treatment was only 84 days was very concerning, given that we know the life-saving and recovery-supporting effects of this medication last when a person is on it.
The next step?
What we looked at then, because we know a lot of people go on and off medications, either because the prescriber is concerned about them and does not want to keep caring for them, or the person relapses onto drugs, or they're actually concerned that they still have addiction if they're staying on these medications. So we want to understand what happened over time.
And Banta-Green says that revealed some good news.
What we saw is that a lot of people went back on these medications 2, 3, or 4 times, and that we never knew when, but eventually it stuck. For the vast majority of people, they eventually really were able to establish longer term periods of time of staying on buprenorphine.
The big takeaway.
So the takeaway message for this is very important, that whether you are a person with opioid use disorder or a family member or a medical provider, if a person's on the medication and then they stop, either because they choose to stop or they relapse to illicit drug use, don't give up. It's important for people to recognize that it takes multiple tries for many people before they actually establish long-term recovery. And this data very clearly shows that many people do well. And it may be that they don't stay on medications long-term until their second, third, or fourth try, but we owe it to them to give them that chance to establish long-term recovery.
But is this really any new information?
So I joke sometimes that my job is to document the obvious. But the reason I document the obvious is that people like insurers and medical providers and policymakers don't want anecdote. they want data. And these data prove what you and I have probably heard from people is, oh, it takes a few times. But these data prove it. They prove that it is worth continuing to offer people medications, even if they decide to go off them or if they relapse. It's worth it to offer them again, because many people are going to do well and it's going to stick eventually. So, right, this isn't the world's biggest surprise. But it proves this anecdote, this story that you and I have heard many times, that, yeah, it took me a few times and then eventually it stuck.
And here's why that matters.
A doctor who says, you know what, I gave a patient a chance and they screwed it up. I'm not going to give them another chance. These data say that is wrong. You should never fire or give up on a patient. And that's really, really important that we have data that proves that.
More importantly.
Right. I didn't do this study because I didn't have a guess as what I might find. I did the study because there are a lot of medical providers firing a lot of patients, and there are a lot of patients who give up because they relapsed and don't think they're worthy of getting back on medications. So I think this is really important information for medical providers, but also for people with opiate addiction and their families to know, don't give up. Try again. It's worth it, and you will succeed.
Banta Green believes this information, along with other projects he's working on, will be vital moving forward to address the opioid crisis in Washington State and beyond.
I'm actually overseeing a study right now that is called Medication First, that works to get people started out on medication the very first day. And we're able to get over half of people started out on medications the same day at homeless services program. So we're really excited about this model of care. And we actually think it's going to be very important, given the Washington State Legislature's push to say we're not going to arrest people, we're going to divert them to care. Well, if you're going to divert people to care who are not looking for care, you better give them care that's really easy to access, where people treat them really nicely. And that's what we do. That's what we do in the medication first model of care, which is happening across many sites in Washington State.
He's saying that ultimatums by providers don't work. Guilt on the part of users doesn't work. What works is persistence and patience. Hannah Scott.
You can ring my bell, ring the bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. Do you know why you buy the things you do? Well, IKEA knows, and Rachel Bell has been researching this. Rachel?
IKEA has been getting in your head for years. They use psychology to get you to buy more stuff. So IKEA was founded in 1943. It has been the world's largest furniture retailer since 2008. And I thought this was an interesting fact. The brand sells a set of its Billy bookcases every 10 seconds.
Wow.
And it's been said that 1 in 10 Europeans were conceived in an IKEA bed. Fun facts that have nothing to do with this story, but just wanted to point those out. All right. So they give three reasons that they get in your head to get you to buy. So the first one is the scarcity effect and the thrill of novelty and something they call bulla bulla. Bulla bulla is a technique used to create the impression that an item is cheap. And they do this by putting a bunch of things in like a big basket. So, you know, when you're in IKEA, you'll see like a huge bin full of, I don't know, straws or stuffed animals or whatever. And your brain assumes that because there are so many, it must be cheap. And also you kind of compare to other items in the store that aren't in those bins, and those seem more expensive. And it's also the thrill of novelty. So they purposely change up these cheap little things, because when you see something new or unexpected, your brain produces dopamine, which makes you feel like you're falling in love or getting a new like on Facebook or whatever. So they say this 1-2 punch of abundance and novelty creates this bulla bulla effect that makes you buy. Now, number two is more interesting to me. IKEAs tend to be outside of major cities. So here in our region, it's in Renton. But for people who don't have cars, it can be hard to get there. Or if you take the bus, it could take all day. So some people end up renting a van if they know they're going to be buying furniture, or they get it delivered. But IKEA does not do free delivery. It costs between $40 and $60 to deliver a desk, as an example. And they said that some people who live hours away from an IKEA will actually make a weekend out of it, and they'll drive in and they'll spend the night, and it will turn into this mini shopping vacation. So the psychology is, if you have to go farther out of your way to get something, you're going to spend more because you want to make it worth your while.
That's absolutely true.
It is. And they call it the sunk cost fallacy. People are more likely to commit to an activity if they've made a significant financial or time investment. And this happens all over the place in our lives. Like, I mean, I did this once where I bought a bunch of paint and I didn't like the color, but I still used it to paint the thing because it's like, well, I don't want to go back to the store and I already spent all this money.
That's right.
So that's number two. And then number three is what they call the open the wallet section. That is the internal name of it at IKEA. When you go through the store, you know, you can't just go wherever you want. It's this maze. You have to go from start to finish and kind of see everything. So they purposely put the more expensive things towards the beginning, like furniture. So maybe you're going in to get a couch. And so you've already swallowed the fact that you're going to spend, let's say, $600 or $700. So once you get to the open wallet section, which is that whole room full of bright colored trash cans and ice trays, all of this cheap stuff that's under $5, it seems so extra cheap compared to the couch you're going to buy that you're like, you know what? I'm going to buy all of this stuff, even though I don't need it. And that is paired with the anchoring effect, which says the first information you see, like that couch, influences your later decisions. So you don't even know that you're consciously doing this, but you've already anchored the price of that couch. So then the $5 trash can just seems like a great deal. And they said that people do this a lot with buying a house or legal judgments or buying all kinds of things.
That's why the real estate agent takes you to the $2 million house first, before showing you the $1.6 million house.
If they're smart. I mean, this is like, these things remind me of, you know, when I bought a car last, it's like, I plan to just go to the dealership that was closest to me so I could do the test drive. And then I thought, okay, once I get the info, then I'll shop around and find the cheapest price. But then it becomes, well, I'm already here. I'll just pay for this because, you know, I already test drove this car. Everybody's really nice. I mean, yeah, I think there is a lot of psychology that we don't even know what's going on. They're influencing us.
And Amazon does it very, very well. Anytime I click on something, even if I'm just passing through, it comes back to haunt me on my email. And for some reason, it appears in news articles. But I've latched on to a pretty good formula. Here's what I do. I look at what it costs, Rachel, and if anything that's above, let's say, $100, I look twice at what it costs, and I ask myself, don't I have something in the attic that I bought 10, 20, 30 years ago that's similar to this that I could just go upstairs, dust off, and use? And many times, the answer is yes, especially when it comes to wicker baskets.
Oh, I didn't know that you loved wicker baskets so much. Now I know what to get you
well,
for the
holidays. Well, I don't necessarily love them, but all I can say is we're not allowed to throw them out in this house, so we have a lot of them.
You are long in wicker baskets.
Yes.
Yes, that is the benefit of being a hoarder, is that you can realize that you already have all this stuff. I totally get thrown by that room of cheap IKEA stuff, even though I know I don't need it, just because it looks fun and things are so cheap, you just think you need it, but I've been getting better too. I always try to rationalize, okay, do I already have this? Do I need this? Do I have room in my drawer for more kitchen goodies? But yeah, I think it works on a lot of people.
And now, thanks to you, Rachel Bell, we are all more informed shoppers.
That is true.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.